Well, hello there, and welcome to Food Lab Talk. I'm your host, Michael Bucker. I'm so excited to welcome two brilliant guests for today's episode. Wendy Lopez and Jessica Jones are nationally recognized registered dietitians and certified diabetes educators. They're the founders of Food Heaven, a multimedia platform originally founded for women and communities of color facing barriers to food, healthcare, and nutrition education. And now the newly launched Diabetes Digital, a trusted source for virtual, personalized nutrition counseling dedicated to diabetes and pre-diabetes. In their highly successful podcast, videos, books, and more, they dive deep into the health and wellness topics with a lens on inclusivity and cultural competency. Wendy and Jess, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I am sure you've been asked this question a million times, so this is million times plus one. How did the two of you both meet?
We met, I think maybe now 15 years ago in Brooklyn, New York. We met through a mutual friend, and shortly after that, we started working together at farmers markets in New York City, doing nutrition education. And cooking demos and teaching people how to incorporate fruits and vegetables in ways that were culturally relevant to where they were from. So that's how we met, and that's how our work relationship started as well. And, you know, from there, it just kind of blossomed into so many other things. But originally it was, you know, Food Heaven was born out of our dedication to educating people around nutrition and cooking.
And then, so talk to me a little bit about how you went from Food Heaven to now your newest venture.
Yeah, so we have been doing Food Heaven for over 13 years, which is a really long time to be doing anything, and especially something online. As you know, the internet has changed a lot in 13 years, kind of always changing and evolving. And we decided that we wanted to evolve with the times, with our vision and all the things. So essentially, we were doing Food Heaven, which for those who are not familiar, it's a multimedia nutrition and wellness platform that included a podcast. And we did a lot of work with different brands, spokesperson work. We would throw events. We had an international retreat every year. So kind of multimedia nutrition education. And Wendy and I, meanwhile, in addition to being dietitians, we were also diabetes educators because we had a huge passion for diabetes. It's something that is very prevalent in our communities. We've all been personally touched by diabetes or have family members who have diabetes or pre-diabetes. And so we've worked in different clinics alongside our work online over the last 10 years. Teaching diabetes classes, pre-diabetes classes, groups, things like that, one-on-one counseling. And so we decided that we wanted to have more of a one-on-one impact with patients. So, you know, in addition to doing the online thing, we kind of wanted to get back to our roots of like one-on-one counseling. And so that's where the Diabetes Digital started. It was how can we use all of our background online, offline to have an impact on patients? And so, yeah, it's kind of just a virtual nutrition, not just, but it's a virtual nutrition counseling company for people with diabetes and pre-diabetes.
Thanks for sharing all of that. Before we take a deeper dive into enabling choice, love to talk a little bit more about the bigger picture for a moment, food systems as a whole. So what are your thoughts about what makes a food system truly inclusive and sustainable? It's an easy question to get the conversation going. So what makes a food system truly inclusive and sustainable?
I think really assessing the needs of the people who are impacted by that system is going to be foundational because, you know, needs vary based on what community you're talking about, what country you're in, what neighborhood you're in. You know, in the neighborhoods that we were working with when we first met, access was one of the biggest issues. That was why we were doing the programs that we were doing. It was to improve access and education because that was a unique challenge in that specific neighborhood. So I think really talking to the people that are impacted the most by the food system to, you know, just kind of learn more about what their needs are, what they would want out of a food system that works in their eyes is going to be really important because they're the main stakeholders.
I can just add to that. Wendy and I, as she mentioned, we both used to work in New York City in farmers markets and underserved communities. So I think that was one solution to this kind of complex problem with like access when it comes to the global food systems. But just what they did at Department of Health in New York was kind of survey different neighborhoods and see like who had limited access to fruits and vegetables, and then strategically placed farmers markets in those neighborhoods, which was very helpful because then people were able to, you know, purchase different foods that were more health promoting. One other thing that they did that I thought was amazing, and I don't know if we do this in California, but this is definitely something in New York. I feel like they pioneered this idea of health bucks. So for people who were using food stamps or EBT, I think it was like for every $3 you spent, you got two free dollars. So it was just like increasing the spending power. I think it was by what, like 30, 40%. And I agree with what Wendy said. It's also making sure that people have access not only to health promoting foods, but also culturally relevant foods. Because so often people want to come into communities and say, like, you should be doing this, or, you know, these are the foods that are going to be helpful. And it's like one list, but it's more effective. And we've seen this firsthand trying to incorporate foods that people enjoy that are part of their cultures and not demonizing those foods.
Yeah. If I can build upon that, Jess, I think in the context of Food Heaven, you've talked about helping deconstruct Eurocentric notions of health. For the audience, could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yes. So I'm so glad you asked this question, because there's actually like something happening I just saw on Instagram right now with some of our dietitian friends. So there is one of our dietitian friends who, she's Latina, and she promotes that we can have our cultural foods and those are part of a healthy diet. And one of the foods that she talks about is salsa. Salsa is a vegetable. And especially if you have, I think it's like 1/3 cup or 1/2 cup or something like that counts as vegetable. It's tomato, it's cilantro, it's onion. And that to me is a perfect example of us taking those culturally relevant foods and reducing some of the stigma and the shame, the messaging that people can get, like they go to the doctor and they say, okay, you have to stop eating all these foods. But the interesting part about the salsa story is like, there's another dietitian that they're kind of, battling is not the right word, but just going back and forth. Like this dietitian's like, no, salsa does not count as a vegetable. And like, they're doing all these videos back and forth. And so I think there's just like a lot of misinformation out there. And there are a lot of people who, in my mind, the person who's saying that it doesn't count isn't fully understanding or being respectful of different cultures. And that can kind of impact people's well-being because, you know, like, yeah, we want people to eat foods that they enjoy.
Understood. I think in your various publications and talks over the years, you've shared that nutrition is not the answer to every health problem. And food isn't actually medicine. But at the same time, we hear so much these days about food is medicine or food as medicine. So I think what you're believing or stating is actually different from some in the nutrition profession. Is that a fair statement or am I misinterpreting?
I think in our approach, we like to zoom out because there's just so many things that impact our food choices beyond our desire to eat healthier. And so, you know, just from personal experience, but also experience working in underserved communities, we think it's really important to look at things like socioeconomic factors, access to healthcare, social relationships, mental health, because oftentimes these things have a stronger impact on health choices than just, oh, you know, I want to eat healthy because I want to reduce my risk for diabetes, for example, or something like that. Or, you know, I want to improve my quality of life. It's usually a lot more complex than that. There's, you know, a lot of real barriers for people, especially if, you know, there's financial hardship. And so, you know, oftentimes what we see in mainstream wellness and nutrition are these cookie cutter approaches that don't really address a lot of the underlying factors that impact food and, you know, people's ability to make informed choices. Those things are overlooked. And so we like to get deeper. Like in the work that we do with Diabetes Digital, we spend a lot of time with people unpacking, you know, what impacts their food choices, what was their childhood like, what are their relationships like, what are all of the things that are happening, because it's not just about what you're eating. It's just so complex, especially for people who have a history of dieting, you know, whether it's for health reasons or because they want to lose weight. People who have body dissatisfaction, which is very common. And so, you know, we just like to dive deeper into those things, because in our experience, when we do that, we see longer lasting changes with nutrition versus a quick fix.
Understood. So let's dive a little deeper into how we actually can enable people to make informed, personally relevant food choices. And it's the combination, informed and then personally relevant as well. And I think that has been a huge focus in your work over the years, from your podcasting, nutrition education, one-on-one counseling, recipe development. You've done a lot. So Jess, with all your experience, what do you think is truly needed to enable people to make truly informed personal food choices that are both nutritious and sustainable?
Ooh, that's a great question. Well, I think figuring out where people are at, what they have time for, what their budget allows as well, because sometimes you can go see a dietitian and they're giving you this list of all these foods and it's like, I can't afford this, or these, you know, elaborate meals and you don't have time to make them. So I think that's part of it. And I think one way, though, just in general for people that can help make things more sustainable, and we'll always talk about this with our clients, but it's going back to basics. Like, do you have a farmer's market in your neighborhood? That food is naturally going to be in season, which oftentimes makes it a little bit cheaper because you're buying foods that are in season versus buying a watermelon in December from the grocery store. So farmers market or community supported agriculture is another one that we always love to recommend to our clients when it is accessible, where people can be a part of a CSA. You pay like shares into it, and then sometimes it'll be like weekly or every other week you can get part of that harvest. And we feel like that is a really great model as well. For some people, though, it might just be as simple as looking up, like there's different lists online, what foods are in season in your neighborhood during this time of year or in your city during this time of year, and maybe like trying to at least pick a couple of things from that category. So I feel like there are a lot of different ways, and it really depends on what a person is interested in doing and able to do.
You obviously get to interact with many, many people throughout the course of a week and a month. And I'm curious, how does the concept of trust come up with you? So, as you know, you can find anything you want on the internet these days, and I can find people who tell me what I eat is just magical, and I can find people who tell me that whatever I eat is the most terrifying thing I could do. So when people find you, how do you build trust with them and they get to trust you, that you dare to help them with ultimately, what I would assume, scientific evidence-based advice?
So the way that I like to build trust is knowing my place in an interaction with a client. So by that, I mean letting them know that I believe that they're the expert in their own life, right? Like I might know some things about food, or I might know some things about diabetes from more of a clinical perspective. I might be able to share some tips, but at the end of the day, you're the expert in your lived experience. And I think that goes a long way with building trust, is just allowing people to share their stories, to share their struggles, to talk about the stigma, especially with diabetes, right? Like there's so much stigma around diabetes. People think it's their fault, or they think that they have to do all these really drastic changes. And that's just not the case. And I think by helping kind of just be like that co-pilot with folks where they're kind of steering the ship, that really helps. And I think another thing that can help is having feedback with like labs. So for example, we like our clients to get their A1C, which is their average blood glucose over a 3-month period of time. We want them to get that checked every 3 months. And so that way we have the data where people can see, hopefully, that the A1C came down based on the small changes they're making, so that they can trust us to know that you don't have to do these intense overhauls or you know, engage in these disordered eating habits, it might be something as simple as cutting out some sugary drinks. You see the A1C come down, then you can trust like, okay, I'm on a good path.
Let me just ask them the follow-up question. So I assume, it's my assumption on my side, I might be totally wrong, is that some clients might come to you as well with their food preferences and their food habits, and they just don't like what you're going to tell them. How do you balance that as a dietitian, ultimately a support person, and the person just doesn't want to hear what is the truth or what they truly would need to hear?
Well, we're not preachy in our approach. So I would say, A, typically as dietitians, I think people think we're the diet police and we're going to just go on like a, you know, I don't know, just like tell you everything you're doing wrong. You need to stop it. But that's not really how it works. Even if I am sharing education, I always ask permission first. So I say, is it okay if I share something with you? And typically people are like, yeah, that's why I'm here. But I do that so that it's not coming across as like unsolicited or I have all the answers. And typically I'll frame it in the way of like, this has worked for other clients, but of course, like you're an individual and this may not work for you, but we can try something else. Also, when coming up with goals, because you mentioned like people not wanting to do things, we typically don't even come up with goals unless people need our help with suggestions. We don't come up with goals they should do. We leave that more so to them. So a typical session might be we're gathering a lot of info and we're asking them, where do you see yourself in 3, 6, 12 months? And then we ask all those questions that I said in terms of like how much time they want to spend with their thinking. And then we might break it down into smaller goals. So when we were just looking at one of our dietitians, the goals that she had set for a client, and I feel like she said something about, I don't know, adding a cup of vegetables to your meal like 3 times per week. And usually that's a goal the patient says that they want to do. They come up with the idea. And we use something called motivational interviewing, which is a strategy to help elicit change from within. So with using motivational interviewing, it's different from how most doctors practice, where they're kind of telling you top down. Motivational interviewing is more so bottom up. Like there are often times where the goal may be to do nothing. Maybe it's just to kind of track what they are doing if they feel like that makes the most sense. And let's say a patient does set a goal. What we'll do, and this is also part of motivational interviewing, is figure out like on a scale from 1 to 10, how likely they feel like they will be in achieving that goal. So 10 meaning like it's no problem whatsoever, and 1 meaning like you're just not doing it. So if somebody has anything under than a 7, we know that that means that they don't feel that strongly about it. And these are also SMART goals too. They don't feel that strongly about it, and we might have to tweak it or take things away. So there, it makes it so that it's never anything like so intense that people are kind of pushing back that hard.
I would love talking to you about my diet because you're not going to tell me what I cannot do.
Absolutely never. Yeah. No, that's not our style.
Question for you. So, and again, it might be my wrong beliefs. By the time people come and see you, probably in general, there are a variety of symptoms as a result of a variety of root causes. And some of the causes might be with the individual, but probably more often than not, it is in the context in which they live, have grown up, and other elements. So as a dietitian or nutrition professional, how do you deal with this notion of you're always at the end versus being able to maybe to go a little bit more upstream and preventing it? Is that an internal struggle for you, or is it something you just accept it is what it is and you help people by the time they're ready to seek help?
Yeah, I think the latter, because people's relationship to food fluctuates always because, you know, life is lifing. So you might, you know, at one point in your life be going through grief or a job loss, or you're a college student, or now you're living alone, or you know, you don't have stable housing. Like there's just so many things that happen in life that impact our food choices. So, you know, it's only going to be consistent for so long until a life situation changes and then you have to adjust. And so, you know, I don't think it's ever too late. I think there are situations that make it more challenging. As a clinician, one of the conditions that I find to be the most challenging and limiting is when someone is in dialysis. You know, like that is really hard and you need really specialized care. And there's a lot of, you know, just like strict guidelines around what to eat. And that's why dialysis centers have dietitians, because it's so specialized. But, you know, just thinking about chronic conditions outside of that, most of them, I think there's a lot of preventative approaches that you can do, not necessarily to reverse the condition or to make it go away, but just to keep it well managed so that you prevent complications from coming on. And, you know, naturally with age, chronic conditions happen to a lot of people. You know, it's just the body isn't working the same way that it used to. And things like hypertension, prediabetes, diabetes, you know, hyperlipidemia, like these things just, you know, start coming on as people become older. There are things that you can do to like reduce risk and things like that, but it's not necessarily someone's wrongdoing. It, you know, it could be genetics, it could just be the aging process, it could be stress, it could be so many different things. So I think there's always the opportunity to come in and provide education for anyone. And if you need that specialized care, then, you know, within the profession, we have people who are able to provide that if that's something that someone needs.
You know, it's the two of you today. And I would say many of our guests have talked about the power of a supportive community. And it seems to me that you've built quite the community online with Food Heaven and now with Diabetes Digital as well. Could you talk a little bit about how your community and your network supports your work and how you support each other?
Well, I think just as dietitians in general, I feel like we're a part of that community. And it was really nice when we launched Diabetes Digital, because so many dietitians shared, they started referring, and you would think that it's a competition, but really it's not. We all have different specialties, or we all take different insurances. We're all in different locations. So I think that's very helpful. And then I think also just on a patient level, one thing that we did before we started Diabetes Digital was we surveyed our audience, who people who did have diabetes or prediabetes, and we asked them what they felt was missing from the care that they were getting. And many of them said they felt like a community was a missing piece. They felt isolated. And I've seen this also in like my one-on-one work with clients. Like everybody thinks that they're the only one going through something. Meanwhile, I'm here meeting with like, you know, 8 people a day, and they're all kind of have similar things happening. And so that's why with Diabetes Digital, we want to have groups. And so we're starting with kind of one support group that's really just a space for people to get that support from other people who might understand what they're going through. And so that's another way that we're trying to form community within this space.
Love it. So what I heard you share as well earlier is that you have evolved over the last 15 years. So from Food Heaven out to Diabetes Digital. If you look in the crystal ball the next 5 years, what are your hopes and aspirations as it relates to enabling individuals to make informed, personally relevant food choices?
We're hoping to grow the company, to grow Diabetes Digital, so that we have more providers from more diverse backgrounds that are able to offer nutrition services to people who need it. Because, you know, as of right now, over 50% of the US population has prediabetes or diabetes. So, you know, we either have one of these conditions or we know someone who does, and we know that the need is there. We offer services in Spanish as well. And so, you know, that's our effort to reach more people and make things more accessible. About half of our providers speak Spanish. And so, you know, we would love to be able to offer more languages and to be able to become licensed in more states. Right now, we're in, I believe, 24 states. So just continue to expand so that we're covering all states in the U.S. And yeah, just continue making things as compassionate and accessible as possible for people that have prediabetes and diabetes.
Having said all of that, when you go back in time 15 years ago, when you first met in New York or Brooklyn, if you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself, what you would do differently? What have you learned over the last 15 years that is worthwhile sharing with this audience of listeners today that is really focused about change making, lessons learned?
That is a really great question. Again, what would I say? I mean, I think just have fun. at the end of the day, like, and in some ways, just having the motto of like having fun and just trying to help has not been advantageous to us because we didn't have a business plan. We were just doing a lot of work and it was just kind of all pro bono free. And so I think for us, it took longer to be able to have a business and be able to work for ourselves full time because we kind of were just going in it with a certain mindset. Having said that, though, I also would say to just cherish all of those milestones because oftentimes, and I'm sure many of the audience members can relate, like you have something great happen and then you're already on to the next thing. So if I could do it all over, it would be like, take yourself out to dinner, buy yourself flowers, celebrate these small milestones because you're really never going to get them back.
Love that. Celebrate more and more frequently. What about you, Wendy? What would you tell yourself?
I think I would tell myself to pause throughout because kind of like what Jess was saying, like things just happen so quickly and, you know, you're going with the flow. And especially, you know, when you're younger, you might not be like thinking things through completely. And I think it's important to just pause along the way and see what's working and what's not working. I think that would have saved us a lot of time. I don't think we did that enough, you know, as we grew as a platform and as a business. So yeah, just like really assessing things where they are and, you know, what is moving you towards the direction that you want to be in so that you can be intentional about what that looks like for you.
Alrighty. With that, I'll thank you both for your time today and the insights shared. Good luck with the ongoing evolution of your company. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Reflecting on today's interview, here are my top three takeaways for change makers. Embrace the change on your own change-making journey. Wendy and Jess demonstrated that it takes courage to be a change maker, fearlessly adapting their own approach as their circumstances shifted. They transformed their own business from Food Heaven to Diabetes Digital. This evolution, rooted in learning and resilience, magnifies their impact on the communities they serve. Approach each challenge with empathy and humility. As Wendy and Jess shared, recognizing their clients as experts in their own lived experiences helps build trust. As change makers, we must listen, honor experiences, and acknowledge struggles. By serving as a co-pilot rather than a captain, we can help empower individuals to begin their own transformative journey. Collaboration enhances impact. Rather than seeing fellow practitioners as rivals, Wendy and Jess embrace allyship. They recognize the immense value in referring clients to experts with diverse perspectives and varied expertise. They also emphasize how support groups can help overcome feelings of isolation and foster a sense of community that catalyzes positive outcomes. At the end of the day, it is about putting people first. For more information about Diabetes Digital, be sure to check out the show notes. And thank you for joining us for this episode. If you liked what you've heard, subscribe to the podcast at foodlabtalk.com or wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and YouTube at foodlabtalk. As we close, I invite you to pursue your own bold vision and take whatever action you can take toward a better food system. Imagine, believe, and most importantly, act. See you next time.